Hello, this is Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, September 10th, 2026. There's a photo on the front page of the News Gazette with the headline, The Public's Pick, and the caption, Deb Reardon, CEO of Clark Lindsay, holds up the Urbana Facilities 2026 People's Choice Award medallion Wednesday evening during the awards banquet at Riggs Beer Company in Urbana. In the News Gazette's annual wide-ranging community poll, Clark Lindsay was voted the area's number one retirement community. An essential component to making our area safer. Tips Group celebrating its 40th year in operation locally. The Champaign County chapter of Crime Stoppers has been recognized on a state and national level. After 40 years, leaders credit some of that success to consistent support from law enforcement coordinators. It was one such coordinator who first wanted to form this Crime Stoppers group in 1986. We didn't have to sell anything, John Nagy said of the initial push to bring members into the board. It's those first two or three sentences they'd say, I'm in. He would become one of the only four coordinators to serve Champaign County Crime Stoppers over its 40-year history so far. No other Crime Stoppers group in the nation can claim that record. The organization will celebrate its 40th anniversary Thursday night with a banquet with all four of those coordinators in attendance, as well as the famed Champaign local, Olympic speed skater Bonnie Blair. Nagy was deputy chief of the Champaign Police Department in 1986 and had heard of Crime Stoppers as a program in other Illinois cities. The more he looked into it, he said, the more he thought it would be a good thing for Champaign. He shared the idea with Judy Yeager, a Champaign City Council member at the time, and they started recruiting local business owners and leaders to form that board. One of the earliest members was John Hecker, who remains on the board currently. The initial board of around 10 members, half the size it is today, began connecting with local law enforcement interested in receiving tips and local businesses willing to help fund rewards. None of that was a hard sell either. The detectives loved it because they were getting all kinds of information anonymously, and what's important is that they'd check it out and it was actually good information, Nagy said. He said they soon realized that in many cases, people involved in criminal activity behavior were turning each other in, protected by anonymity. The Champaign Police Department was the first on board, and the Urbana Police Department soon joined after seeing how the process really did protect tipsters' identities and provided valuable information for detectives. Soon other departments wanted in, and Crime Stoppers became a county institution. The coordinator's role is to be a liaison to those local law enforcement agencies and bring back cases involved with the help of tips to the board with suggested reward amounts. The coordinator also helps handle determining the crime of the week, which is whatever crime local law enforcement decides needs some attention to try to encourage tips. Usually this means publishing images of a suspect to see if anyone can identify them. Troy Daniels, who is now the Parkland College police chief, was the second member of law enforcement to take on the coordinator position. He also worked with the Champaign Department at the time and would serve as deputy chief. In fact, all four individuals who have served as coordinator for Champaign County Crime Stoppers were also Champaign deputy chief of police at some point. Daniels oversaw a major shift in technology for the organization. Originally, all tips came through a single phone line, which had to be staffed by civilian employees at the police department. During his tenure, he helped the organization begin to work with a program called TipsOff, where tips could come in through emails and later text messages. TipsOff was then replaced by a program called P3 Tips, which many Crime Stoppers groups use. It also has an app and website. The program helped track tips and how much individuals were being rewarded for them, but even more importantly, it allowed for detectives to reach back out and have conversations with tipsters without revealing their identities. Just that ability was a game changer for detectives to get more detail about tips and up-to-date information. Daniels referred to tips as a way for officers to get pointed in the right direction, whether that was toward the right suspect or away from the wrong one. All we need is just that arrow to at least point in the right direction so we can start to build other independent evidence that can be used against someone to help show that they were responsible for the case, Daniel said. A Crime Stoppers tip is never used as evidence because it's an anonymous source. All it does is give law enforcement an arrow. While police have always relied on information from the public to aid in investigations, Daniel said the Crime Stoppers program is the safest way for that information to be passed along if there is any reason for a tipster to feel unsafe communicating with law enforcement. After Daniels, Jeff Kuhn became coordinator and oversaw yet another shift for the operation. While anonymity itself already helps many tipsters be willing to come forward, reward money is also a massive part of how Crime Stoppers motivates people to share information. Rewards are only provided to tips that actually lead to a case being solved, and amounts are determined by how useful a tip was and the severity of the case itself. The Champaign chapter has received some national attention for a successful program adding additional incentives to tips that lead police to collect illegal guns and remove them from the streets. For a large part of the chapter's history, rewards were handed off in person to tipsters or to whoever those tipsters might send to collect them, with board members standing at some meeting place waiting to pass them off. Hecker said this has never resulted in any issues, but it was always a little bit of a concerning situation for everyone involved. Kuhn was able to bring about a process of working with a bank to give money to tipsters with even more anonymity. He said that before becoming coordinator, he was a nighttime patrol officer who had very little to do with investigations and only general knowledge of how helpful tips could be. I always joked that everybody I dealt with was intoxicated or under the influence of some kind of narcotic, so I don't have real-world contacts a lot of times, Kuhn said. This opened a door for me professionally to meet with a lot of different people. Kuhn praised the group for being streamlined with a team of willing volunteers, but also a board of people willing to speak their minds and push for various points of view or efforts. It was important to him to stick around for a long time, carrying on both Nagy's and Daniel's legacies in that regard. It isn't just a fly-by-night kind of operation. You just step in and then a year later get promoted and go do something else, Kuhn said. I wanted to ensure consistency with the program, and that's why I wanted Greg Manzana to take over when I left. Manzana is the current coordinator of only 2 years so far, and is the current Champaign Deputy Chief of Police. Ex-superintendent sues district over alleged non-payment. Board didn't live up to separation agreement's terms, Geddes claims. A year after being dismissed as Danville superintendent, Alicia Geddes has filed a lawsuit against the school district in federal court in Urbana. Geddes is seeking unspecified damages for breach of contract, reputational harm, interference by two school board members who opposed her settlement agreement, and violation of her First Amendment rights. The 10-year district head was placed on paid administrative leave in February 2025 when the board approved a separation and settlement agreement worth more than $500,000. She'd started working remotely and quit attending school board meetings the previous fall due to what she said was threats made against her. Despite the board's request that she return to in-person work, she never did. Don Hart, Geddes' assistant superintendent, filled in on an interim basis in her absence and was hired permanently last summer. According to Geddes' settlement agreement with the board, she was to be paid through the 25-26 school year, then receive $250,000 in liquidated damages. The district has not made that payment, Geddes said. Plaintiff has suffered the loss of over $300,000 owed, including 12 unpaid vacation days and health insurance costs, the lawsuit alleges. Geddes also claims that she was ordered to repay $203,000 to cover teacher retirement system penalties. The lawsuit specifically mentions Darlene Halloran and Kim Corley, two of the three school board members who voted against Geddes' settlement agreement with the district. Neither Geddes' attorney, Jerome Davis, nor district officials could be reached for comment. Teacher of the Week, Danelle Lafoe, Next Generation Preschool, Champaign. Danelle Lafoe's first inkling that she'd like to become a teacher came as a 14-year-old when she babysat neighborhood kids. After earning her associate's degree in early childhood education at Danville Area Community College, she worked at daycares in her hometown of Danville before taking a job at Next Generation Preschool in Champaign, where she's worked for the last 26 years. Her day-to-day dedication to teachers and students is truly inspirational, said Susan Kim, whose son is in LaFoe's class. Over the years, I personally know countless families who have really appreciated Ms. Danielle being their child's teacher. I believe the reason my son transitioned very smoothly to the school setting is because of her, and I am very thankful for the strong foundation she has set him up to succeed both academically and, even more important, socially. I find my work important because I am able to provide families a sense of comfort and reassurance as I nurture and guide their children through some of the most important years of development. I became a teacher because I have always felt I could relate to young children, and I am able to provide fun and engaging activities for each stage of their development. I have a good sense of what individual children need to feel loved and safe and have fun. My favorite lesson that I teach is our tree study. Children love being outside and exploring nature. We can incorporate all areas of learning while playing outside. My most fulfilling moments on the job are when children come running into the classroom in the morning and they do not want to leave at the end of the day. They are excited to share stories from home and be with classroom friends. I keep students engaged by being as silly as they can be. We can do a lot of singing and dancing as we learn academic concepts. Something else I am passionate about is spending as much time as I can with my family and friends. My husband and I enjoy boating, golfing, and just hanging out with friends. We have a daughter, son-in-law, and 11-year-old granddaughter whom we love to spend time with. My parents, sister, niece, and nephew get together for all the holidays, birthdays, and special occasions throughout the year. My favorite teacher in school was Ms. Anderson. She taught biology and Spanish throughout my high school years. She had high expectations in her classroom and taught great organizational skills and life skills to help us succeed in school and future occupations. I feel I carry this teaching style with me, even in a young classroom. My little students have structure in my classroom that leads to independence and great self-awareness and self-esteem. If I weren't a teacher, it is very hard to imagine what else I would be doing if I were not a teacher. It has been such a great part of who I am throughout my life. I would need to find an occupation where I could still be serving families in some capacity. The first responders, the firefighters of Tin House, just across from Ground Zero, carry on their work while dealing with tourists, too. Sal Argano got lucky when the World Trade Center was struck by hijacked jets on September 11, 2001. The New York City firefighter was in the Brooklyn Borough on loan to another station, rather than at his usual post at the small Manhattan firehouse just across from an intersection from the Twin Towers. He rushed downtown to find his firehouse badly damaged but still standing. Six of its members, he later learned, were among the 343 New York City firefighters killed in the World Trade Center's collapse. If I weren't sent out on rotation, there would have been a good chance I would not be here today, Argano says. I think about that all the time. Almost 25 years later, Argano, now 65, is still on duty at the firehouse, the last of the firefighters assigned there in 2001 who still works there. Today, the crews of the firehouse respond to emergency calls, but also serve as a de facto part of the 9/11 memorial, visited by crowds of tourists daily. Some visitors come by specifically to see the large bronze relief along the sides of the building listing the names of the firefighters killed on 9/11. Others pause to take the selfies as they pass by on their way to the National 9/11 Memorial Plaza across the street, drawn by the sight of Engine 10 and Ladder 10, the gleaming trucks sitting in the garage that give the station its name, Tin House. This is definitely one of those companies where if you don't want to ingratiate yourself to the public, it's definitely not the right place, said Captain Thomas Brody, who commands Ladder 10 and has worked at the station since 2016. People around the world know this firehouse. They're going to come by and say hello. Tin House served key roles during and after 9/11. Brody, now 55, was still in the fire academy on 9/11. Cadets grabbed their gear and were bused to Ground Zero. The debris hung so thickly in the air around the fallen towers that it looked like it was snowing, he said. It was a beautiful sunny Tuesday, and then you're in this kind of apocalyptic atmosphere, Brody said. It was a little overwhelming, he said. to say the least. In the days after the attack, Tin House served as both command center and safe space for weary first responders, he said. As the years passed, its crew had a front-row seat to the area's rebirth. Robert Favada joined Ladder 10 in 2008, fresh out of the academy. In those early years, he worked beside a giant hole teeming with construction activity. Now 46, he looks out at a transformed landscape. A pair of waterfall pools sits in the footprint of the old towers, ringed by parapets etched with the names of nearly 3,000 victims. Below ground, the 9/11 museum houses mangled steel beams, a destroyed fire truck, and other artifacts. New skyscrapers ring the memorial. When I got here, there was nothing, Favada says. I never thought they were going to finish. Endless streams of visitors stop by. Argano can be found most days perched near the station's open bay doors, patiently answering questions, shaking hands, and posing for photos. He says Tin House firefighters have a unique charge. They're both living testaments to the events of 9/11, as well as public faces, the centuries-old fire department. Argano says he tries to impress on younger firefighters, many increasingly not even born before the attacks, the importance of treating every visitor with respect. This is not like any other firehouse, he said. We have our fire duty, we have our responses, but then we have a responsibility toward the people outside. He acknowledges the task is not always easy. The packs of gawking tourists can be relentless. Their questions can sometimes come across too personal, too insincere, or just simply out there. Many of the younger firefighters tend to keep a lower profile for that reason, he said. After responding to an early morning call this particular day, most of the crew heads to the back of the station to stow their gear or upstairs to help prepare lunch. Argano, meanwhile, chats up a firefighter from France and his wife and then invites them into the station. He points to a wall of patches from the fire departments across the world that have been gifted over the years, as well as the well-worn helmets hanging in the rafters. At another point, though, a lady asks, perhaps a bit too flippantly, what's so special about Tin House? Argano shrugs, it's just a fire station. After she departs, he says it simply wasn't worth the effort. If I need to explain to you all of that, then it's like, pull up a seat, Argano said. Let me take another cigarette. It's going to be a long one. Tin House members reflect on 9/11 milestone. Favada considers the approaching 25th anniversary is likely one of his last before retirement. He worries, though, if he's done enough to keep the memories of Tin House alive. When I got here, so many of the guys worked 9/11, they told me their stories of that day, Favada said, choking on tears. I just hope I can give like a percentage of what they told me to the younger guys. Brody, meanwhile, handed in his retirement papers Tuesday. His last day will be in October. It's interesting to think my first day in the field was right across the street, and this is where I'm going to end my career, said Brody, who writes screenplays in his spare time and has already had two of them turned in Hallmark Channel movies. But Argano, who drives Engine 10, isn't quite ready to pack it in. He fears something will be lost when there's no one there who still remembers. I'm not done. I'm going to be here as long as I can, Argano said. I'm going to keep telling them what I know, what I saw, and I've been through, telling them the history of this firehouse, everything I can remember. Unacceptable. As predicted, delays in postmarking mail-in ballots disenfranchise primary voters in both Washington and Oregon, officials say. The number of ballots rejected for late postmarks has soared in the vote-by-mail states of Washington and Oregon, according to newly released data highlighting concerns about recent changes in U.S. Postal Service operations ahead of this fall's pivotal midterm election. The struggling agency has been consolidating its operations with an emphasis on regional hubs in an effort to save billions of dollars. Some U.S. senators and election officials have been warning for months that the changes could delay the application of postmarks to ballots, even if they're mailed on or before Election Day. That would prevent otherwise valid votes from counting. The prediction is being borne out, they say, with thousands of voters having their ballots rejected during this year's primaries. More Oregonians had their voices go unheard just because their ballots couldn't make it through the mail in time, Oregon Secretary of State Tobias Reed told a news conference Tuesday, referring to the state's primary in May. That is unacceptable. The operational changes at the post office are compounding worries about the future of voting by mail, especially in some western states where the method is universal and widely popular. President Donald Trump has repeatedly attacked mail-in voting, falsely claiming that it's riddled with fraud, despite having voted by mail himself. Over the weekend, his administration asked the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn a judge's ruling blocking his executive order that seeks to restrict mail-in voting, a method used by nearly one-third of voters in the U.S. States rush to install more drop boxes. Reid said he is asking lawmakers for emergency funding to install 20 new ballot drop boxes in areas where they're not otherwise easily accessible to voters. Washington Secretary of State this year has spent about $300,000 to reimburse counties for the addition of 21 drop boxes. In two rural Washington counties, both of which have reliably backed Trump, ballots rejected for late postmarks represented more than 4% of all ballots cast in last month's primary. Senator Maria Cantwell, Democrat, Washington, called it ironic that postal changes might disenfranchise some of Trump's most stable supporters. The Postal Service is disenfranchising voters across the United States with policies that are leaving them with a ballot that was cast but never counted, she said. In December, the Postal Service finalized a rule clarifying that postmarks don't necessarily reflect the date the agency first took possession of a piece of mail, but rather the day it was handed in one of its processing centers. Those processing centers are increasingly likely to be farther from certain communities due to recent consolidations. And since last year, Postal Service policy has dictated that mail is transported once a day rather than twice from post offices or collection boxes that are more than 50 miles from a postal distribution center. Postal Service urges voters to mail ballots early. In a written statement, the Postal Service acknowledged that changes in how it transports mail could result in postmark delays. It is noted that anyone who wants to ensure their ballots are postmarked on time can go into a post office and ask for it to be stamped manually free of charge. Our consistent message to voters who choose to vote by mail is to mail early, at least 1 week before ballots are due, the statement said. Some 7,314 ballots that arrived in the mail during Oregon's week-long grace period for this year's May primary were not counted because they were postmarked after Election Day, a rejection rate of 13%, up from 9.5% 2 years ago, 2 years earlier, Reid said. In Washington, the number of late postmarked ballots first jumped last year after postal changes took effect. Officials responded by urging people to get ballots in early and installing more drop boxes. Drop box use did increase in this year's primary, but the number of late postmarked ballots was still a problem, 20,267, up from 16,131 in 2024. The data paralleled numbers in California, where during this year's June primary, about 93,500 voters had their ballots rejected because they were postmarked or arrived too late to be counted. Rural counties heavily affected. In some rural Washington counties where voters often return ballots by mail because drop boxes are farther away, the data was most pronounced in Stevens County in Washington's northeastern corner. The rate at which mailed ballots were rejected for late postmarks quadrupled. Stevens County Auditor Lori Larson said on August 7th, 3 days after the primary and during the state's grace period, four ballots to arrive, her office received a haul of 547 ballots with late postmarks. There were so many that she initially thought the mail must have been interrupted by wildfires in the region, but when she looked at the zip codes they originated from, she realized that wasn't the case. To me, this is a number that suggested that many, if not all of those folks, thought they were timely delivering their ballot into USPS custody, she said. Trump, oil prices unlikely to fall until after midterms. President Donald Trump said Wednesday that oil prices that have surged because of the Iran war likely won't come down until after U.S. midterm elections. Oil prices on Wednesday jumped more than 3%, pushing international Brent crude past the $100 threshold for the first time since July as salvos between the U.S. and Iran escalated. Right after the election, oil prices are going to be tumbling downward, Trump said. I think it's going to take a little bit longer than the midterm. Trump, in an exchange with reporters before traveling to Dallas for the midterm Republican convention, added that he believes Iran will finally relent after the pivotal elections are held in the U.S. They're desperate to try and affect the election so they can get a nice, weak group of people in there and leave them alone and let them have their nuclear weapons. Trump said, "I think the war is going to end immediately after the election because they can't hold out any longer." At the outset of the war, the president said it would last a matter of weeks. The conflict is now in its seventh month, the war pitting the U.S. and Israel against Iran, and led to a dramatic slowdown of oil moving through the Strait of Hormuz, through which about 20% of the world's petroleum passed prior to the conflict. The comments were a striking acknowledgment from Trump about the status of the conflict as his Republican administration faces mounting pressure to address high gas prices as the war in Iran grinds on with no conclusion in sight. Trump last week downplayed the conflict to small potatoes, even as Republicans expressed concern the war will loom large with voters left navigating elevated gas prices and higher inflation. The U.S. has drained its strategic petroleum reserves, which in early August fell below 300 million barrels, by more than 100 million barrels since the start of 2026. Trump's prediction that the war won't be wrapped up until after the November 3rd, after Vice President J.D. Vance last week steered clear of predicting that the conflict would be over by the midterm elections, in which Republicans are trying to hang on to their narrow majorities in Congress. Vance told reporters he didn't want to set artificial timelines for the war's end. Medical issue or child abuse? New law aims to safeguard parents from rushes to judgment by DCFS, others over childhood injuries and ailments. Starting next year, Illinois will have new safeguards in place to prevent parents from being wrongly accused of child abuse or neglect when their children visit a doctor or hospital emergency room for unexplained injuries or ailments. For advocates, the law speaks to the horrific circumstances families can endure when a medical issue is misconstrued as abuse. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed the bill in July after it passed the Democrat-controlled General Assembly without opposition, 110-0 in the House and 59-0 in the Senate, with three Senate Republicans from the legislative superminority among its co-sponsors. But behind that vote was a years-long debate between family rights advocates and doctors that had exposed hard feelings on both sides. Family rights advocates, including the Family Justice Resource Center, which pushed for the law, were perceived by some as not taking a strong enough stand against child abuse, while the medical community was tagged as requiring families to prove their innocence from the outset. For Tara Crady and her husband, that scare happened more than a decade ago. Crady said courts ordered their then infant son temporarily placed with her parents after she had medical personnel examine a spot on his ankle that turned out to be from healed fractures. Crady, who has a background in child advocacy, said she and her husband eventually learned their son had a metabolic bone disease, but a child protection case was filed and it took well over a year for them to be cleared of wrongdoing by child welfare officials. "I fought against child abuse, so the fact that anybody would look at us like we would hurt our child was tragic," said Crady, now the treasurer of the Resource Center. "We had to live with my parents under a safety plan, so his first birthday, his first Christmas, everything, we were watched. We couldn't be alone with him." Unlike the new law, when the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services requests a professional's medical or forensic opinion during an investigation into whether a child's injury or illness may stem from abuse or neglect, it must make reasonable efforts within 24 hours to tell the child's parents. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette, Part 1, for Thursday, September 10, 2026. Please stay tuned for Part 2.